welcome to the Provider Podcast. I'm Adam Brimmer. Today, we're talking about the issue which more than any other comes through as trust leaders' number one concern, workforce. Recent industrial action has brought the issue into focus as never before, highlighting worries over pay, conditions of work, and staff well-being. Staff vacancies have been going up even as demand for care has increased, adding to pressures that were compounded by the pandemic. Too often, we hear of staff being overstretched, burnt out, and demoralised. NHS Providers has pushed hard for a fully costed and funded workforce plan to meet future needs. Much delayed, we're told it's on its way, but still we wait. So what is the state of the NHS workforce? A good place to start is the staff survey. I've been talking to NHS Providers Workforce Policy Advisor Sarah White about what the latest findings tell us. So, Sarah, the staff survey was carried out late last year as winter pressures took hold. We know that vacancies were at all-time high. There was the growing cost of living crisis, looming industrial action, and sure enough, the findings reflect worrying concerns in the survey. And we've talked a lot on this podcast about staff burnout and unsustainable workloads. This really gives an indication, doesn't it, of how severe those problems have become.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think anyone can kind of deny the gravity of the situation we're in at the moment with staff wellbeing. The staff survey found that in 2022, only a quarter of respondents said that they never or rarely have unrealistic time pressures in their job. So that's a really difficult environment to be working in. And under half of staff said they often or always feel worn out at the end of their shift. So it's not really a surprise that levels of burnout and morale are where they are. And I think particularly given the wider context and the challenges there. So, you know, we're seeing a really difficult economic environment. We know there's huge shortages across the service, huge pressure in terms of tackling care backlogs and increasing demand and widespread industrial action. All of this is off the back of the trauma of working on the front line through COVID, which I think gets forgotten in a lot of the discussions because the state of play now is really severe. People kind of looking at the immediate state of things. But I think we kind of have to bear in mind that COVID context to where we are now because staff are just, they're really, really exhausted. And we're seeing that in levels of vacancy, levels of kind of leaver rates going back up. And also just what staff are telling us and what our members are telling us. We know they're really worried. So it's definitely challenging.
And you say staff are exhausted. They're also thinking of leaving the NHS, aren't they?
Exactly, yes, kind of a natural conclusion to those factors. So the surveys showed that just under a third of staff often think about leaving their organisation, and that's actually at a five-year high now. So it's the worst we've seen it for ages. We've also seen now data from NHS Digital for the period December 21 to December 22. It shows the leaver rate is now 12.2%, which is one of the highest, I think it's the third highest on record. And the other two highest figures were both last year as well. So it's challenging. It's really challenging. And we know that the cost of living increases have been exacerbating this as well, particularly in conjunction with the below inflation pay awards that were given nationally last year. So 68% of our members told us that they've seen a significant or severe impact as a result of increasing costs of living on staff leaving their trust to go and work in other sectors. So it's a challenge. There's a lot of draw there to sectors which can offer similar work. So particularly we see challenges around estate staff and administrative staff who can do similar work in other sectors for better pay. But it's not all doom and gloom. We know that our members are doing fantastic work to support staff wellbeing at a local level. So, you know, we've heard stories of innovative training approaches, reward programs, additional financial support for colleagues who are struggling with the cost of living. And that's reflected in the staff survey results on leadership approaches. I think while there's a lot that's really grave in those findings, it's really positive that 70% nearly of respondents said their immediate manager takes positive interest in their health and well-being. And over 70% of respondents agree that their immediate manager values their work. So while we know it's a really challenging context, we can see that people are doing their best to look after each other within the service. And the leadership that enables that is really important. And that's where our members kind of sit.
So some shards of light coming through there amid fairly gloomy, wider picture. And you talked about the cost of living impact there. And of course, pay has been at the heart of the recent wave of industrial action. Another really worrying area that we always look to in the NHS staff survey is race equality and discrimination. And that is still a concern, isn't it?
Definitely. So overall, the percentage of ethnic minority staff working in the NHS has been increasing year on year. And also, we've now seen an increase in ethnic minority representation at senior management level, which is great. Whilst we're seeing progress in those areas, we know that the ethnic minority staff are still less likely to report that their organisation is fair when it comes to career progression and development opportunities when compared to white peers. So that's really significant. And that's a huge retention issue as well as an issue of discrimination. We also know that staff from ethnic minorities are more likely to experience discrimination than their white peers as well. So yeah, and we kind of have to take this in the round as well with other protected characteristics. So there's some really useful findings around disabled staff in the staff survey results. So there's a really welcome reduction in the number of disabled staff reporting experiences of harassment, bullying or abuse from a manager. But only a third of disabled staff feel valued for their work compared to almost half of non-disabled staff. So there's some balances there that aren't right. And we know that. And we know that there's a lot of work being done on this. And we, as an organisation, as NHS providers, we recognise the importance of instilling values and behaviours which create a more equal, diverse and inclusive health service. And we support our members to do this. So our race equality programme is a huge part of what we do there. And also nationally, we see a lot of work. For instance, when the new medical workforce race equality standard data came out last month, we know that NHSE responded with five quite significant commitments to tackle race inequality in medicine, from kind of addressing disproportionate disciplinary action taken against ethnic minority staff to ensuring better representation of ethnic minorities across staff side representative organisations. So there's lots happening in that space, but progress is stubbornly slow. So it's going to remain a really, really key focus for us. And we'll be encouraging national policymakers to keep that at the core of what they're doing as well.
So a lot of challenges you've described there, and a whole range of issues. We've been calling for a long-term workforce plan, fully costed and funded. How fundamental is that to addressing these staffing issues?
Very, in a word. You know, we're looking at a vacancy rate of 1 in 11 posts at the moment. And that's likely to be an underestimate, because once a post has been advertised several times without being filled, it no longer is logged as a vacancy. But the unmet demand remains there. So it's high. And it's not surprising that only a quarter of staff feel there's enough staff in their organisation for them to do their job properly. And again, the impact that has on kind of your morale at work, that's huge. And a long-term workforce plan would be transformative in knowing what's happening, knowing where more staff will be coming from, knowing how demand is going to be met. We know that workforce shortages are the key limiting factor in bringing down waiting lists and enabling consistently high delivery of care quality. So we are sat right now waiting for this long-term workforce plan, which we were so pleased that the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt committed to in his autumn 22 statement, but we still haven't seen. So, you know, there's a huge and important ask there of national policymakers, of government and of Treasury, to ensure that that plan does come to fruition, that it is funded, that its recommendations are implemented, and that it's updated regularly, because, you know, as the needs of patients and populations change, it kind of, the workforce in the NHS has to match that. And it's the mismatch we're seeing now which is causing so many of these staffing issues.
And Sarah, we've been going through a period of massive turbulence in the NHS workforce with industrial action, a whole series of strikes by various different staff groups. When you reflect on that, almost regardless of how things come down to land now, what are your concerns about the legacy of this period of industrial action?
That's a really good question. I think it feels very weighty at the moment. There's a lot hanging in the balance with this action. Staff are at this point now because they feel so undervalued, because they are so exhausted. And, you know, yes, the 22-23 pay award, which was significantly below inflation, has triggered this action. But we know that staff are striking about so much more than that. It's the conditions they've been working in and the demands placed upon them, the expectations they feel. And we know kind of all the data we have on staff dedication to the job in the NHS is incredible. Like, they are some of the most wonderful people, but to be pushed to the point of wanting to take strike action is really significant in and of itself. They know the impact that that has on patients and on their colleagues, and, you know, they know how significant it is. So, yeah, the lasting legacy of this strike action could be enormous, because it's about how NHS staff feel valued. So the current and future NHS workforce kind of hangs in the balance here. And we know the NHS doesn't exist without its staff. It's so incredibly important that we have enough of the right staff. And the stakes just couldn't be higher. We desperately need to see resolution to these disputes. And I think, as difficult as it is, there is a real opportunity here for government and staff side reps to truly listen to each other about where the issues lie and kind of come with open minds to reach creative solutions to address these ongoing, really systemic issues, which include pay, but cover so much more than that. So I'm keeping fingers and toes crossed for a creative, positive, long-term solution here. But yeah, we will have to wait and see.
Sarah White. One of the big concerns around the NHS workforce is retention. And one of the areas where staff pressures are greatest is in emergency departments. A recent joint study by the University of Bath and the Royal College of Emergency Medicine has looked at the underlying retention challenges and considered some solutions. I asked the principal author, Dr. Joe Daniels, about the key factors in emergency departments that makes staff want to leave the NHS.
So retention in emergency care has been an issue for over a decade. So more than 10 years ago, there was a workforce that was looking at retention in the NHS, in particularly in emergency care. But certainly the research we've done over the last couple of years has identified that, well, firstly, to sort of name it, that the pandemic has certainly put a spotlight on well-being, which is a factor that we know is associated with retention. However, these things are they're linked and distinct but overlapping. And in our research, what we found was that actually there are a number of key factors that people identify. So we identified these factors by interviewing both individuals and groups over a series of projects. What it highlighted was that actually people are working in environments that are not really fit for purpose. They're either untenable in terms of spaces to work, spaces to rest, access to food. So really, those basic needs not being met, things that we would all expect in our own work environment. So no surprises there, really. Things like not really having any control over their rotas, for example. I heard lots of stories about people finding it difficult to get time off for their weddings or for children's events. So that was one of the key things that really struck us, was meeting basic needs. But also what came across, and something that I think people working in the NHS will be familiar with, is a bit of a negative culture, a blame culture, particularly high-pressured environments such as the emergency department, for example. But more than that, what people were really looking for was to be nurtured in a way that we all would, really. There wasn't a lot of investment in people. And actually, if people don't feel valued, then they're going to leave. And that's what we've heard a little bit about in the strikes, is that actually this is about money, but also it's about people feeling valued in the NHS and how critical that is. But two other things came up as well. One was access to support. So how do people get support? What kind of care is available? We know that recently the government withdrew funding for the wellbeing hubs, but some hospitals do have staff support systems, very good staff support services, but people don't necessarily know how to access that. So that was a real issue. And finally, one thing which I think is really important, and it came up, is leadership. So we see a lot about leadership, the importance of it. We also see that actually people that aren't always trained to become leaders, often the people who lead are people who are competent, who are confident, but they don't necessarily have the skills. And actually there's a knock-on effect there. We hear a lot of talk about compassionate, inclusive leadership. But what we see out there are half-day workshops, and actually a half-day workshop in compassionate leadership, when you're working in a high-pressured environment that's 24 hours non-stop, actually you're asking a lot of somebody. So the question is, who's supporting those leaders and how do we keep them in the job? So these are the four key areas. I think that basic needs was really, really important, that really came out there, basic needs for all.
Yeah, and of course, those operational pressures are absolutely still at large in the NHS. There's the added pressure coming from industrial disputes. How realistic is it now to expect any real progress?
Well, there's no question. This is a really difficult time, and it's a difficult time to make changes. Certainly, a lot of the work that I've been doing in attempting to engage policymakers, you know, people's perspectives and spotlights are elsewhere on the bigger picture, the systemic issues. And it is important that, you know, we have that right to strike. It's vital in a well-functioning democracy. But the wheels do keep turning. People are still turning up at work and these problems are still ongoing. So I think we need to commit to making progress where we can, identifying what we do. So in the report that we produce that's available on the Royal College of Emergency Medicine website on workforce, we've made recommendations on different system levels. So obviously we all know that they need to be changes at government level and professional level, but we can also make changes on an NHS trust level. One of the issues over the last decade is that some of the bodies who are actually lobbying for really important changes, such as the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, they're limited by the fact that they don't have mandatory power. But what we can do is use some of those documents that we've produced, some of the recommendations we've made and the college bodies have made, to lobby the government for change. But I do think we also need to look a little bit closer to home. So in the recommendations that we've made, we've identified that there are ways that NHS trusts can start to support changes in their workplaces, by making clearer lines of accountability, for example, by making change to their rota systems within their department, within their trust. So I think it's really easy to get distracted by the bigger picture. And often people come to me and say, well, you know, these things that you're recommending are quite small changes. But actually, at the moment, that is really where we should be looking. What can you do in your team or in your trust or in your service to make those kinds of changes? And that's really where our research and our policymaker engagement is at, is thinking about, at each level, what can we do and who can we target to make these changes, while bearing in mind that actually the bigger problems are going to take time and money really to solve.
Clearly in your work, you've focused on emergency medicine. Are there wider lessons though here that are applicable on a much bigger scale?
For sure. And some of the work that I've been doing in terms of making sure that this research gets to the people who need to read it most has highlighted that actually these principles apply to us all. These are lessons around humanity, really, in the sense that actually we all need our basic needs met at work. We all need to feel valued, know where to go for support. We all learn from our leaders. So if our leaders don't take breaks, we don't take breaks. And I've heard this across different NHS settings. So in that respect, you know, these principles apply across the board. But what's different here, certainly, that I want to highlight is the emergency care context. You know, it's a very high pressure environment, the highest rates of burnout, the highest rates of staff loss, so highest rates of problems with retention because of the pressure that they're facing. And I guess we need to be mindful that actually, in fact, one of the questions I asked in the research was, you know, given all of these difficulties, why do you stay? And they all said, because we love it, because this is a really stimulating environment, but we're at risk of eroding that goodwill of those people who are sacrificing their well-being to being there in our hour of need. So I do think that we need to lobby to put emergency care high on the political agenda and to ensure that, you know, the principles within the long-term work plan are relevant to this group, while being aware that actually, you know, this is not changing the face of science, this research. A lot of this is common sense. But actually, we really need to focus on making this an important priority across the board.
Dr. Jo Daniels, and you can find out more about that research on the Royal College of Emergency Medicine website. So what's being done here and now to lift staff wellbeing in the health service? In the NHS Staff Survey, Pennine Care NHS Foundation Trust is the most improved mental health and learning disability trust in the country for being a good place to work. I asked the Chief Executive, Anthony Hassell, about the steps they'd put in place.
Yeah, thank you. And obviously, I'm very proud of those results, but equally not complacent. Any type of feedback is a gift, and I'm really grateful to the 50% of our staff who chose to fill in the staff survey this year, which in itself is an improvement on previous years. So we've seen a 10% increase in the number of people who are completing the survey this year. But on that question of would you recommend your organisation as a place to work, we have seen a 7% increase in 2022 from 2021. And as you've said, that makes us the most improved mental health trust in the country on that particular question. And even since 2019, we see a 4% increase on that particular question. So for me, I'm really pleased about that, but there's absolutely much, much more to do, because while 66% of our staff are saying that they would recommend us as a place to work, obviously, conversely, that means there's 34% that aren't. And I've got a very clear ambition that we become the best mental health trust to work in the country. So my mission for the next 12 months is to convince that 34% that actually we are as good a place to work as we can be.
What are the particular challenges you face on this as a mental health trust?
Yeah, and I think there are particular challenges. You know, we cover 5 greater Manchester boroughs for our core services. So that's Bury, Rochdale, Oldham, Tameside and Stockport. We deliver services in some areas across the whole of the Northwest, and we operate across 88 different sites. And so 4,000 staff operating across 88 sites. That means actually in terms of communication, that means in terms of visibility, that means in terms of, you know, that direct staff engagement. That's different to being able to walk around my 1 or 2 hospitals that I might run. So that geographical spread is really, really challenging. But also, actually, we employ a really diverse range of staff, both healthcare staff, but also social care staff. And so, you know, there's a real need to adopt really innovative and flexible ways of both engaging and being visible as a leader in our organisation.
Yeah, well, you've clearly been doing something right, given those improvements that you described. What would you say are the top 2 or 3 factors behind the improvement that you've seen?
So I think this is a really important question, and understanding the evidence behind really good staff and employee engagement, I think, is part of this. So understanding that if you've got a set of behaviours in your organisation, which we have worked very, very, very hard to develop and define, and they are kindness, ingenuity, fairness and determination, that we live those values through everything that we do, both as leaders, but also as colleagues in the organisation. So we recruit through the lens of those values, we appraise through the lens of those values, and I expect all of my leadership team to lead through the lens of those values. So leadership behaviours, really, really, really important. The second thing I'd say is having really, and particularly important in an organisation like mine, is really, really, really strong comms. Because if you ask any group of staff in any organisation that I've ever worked in what could be better, they will say communication. So having really strong, defined, regular, easy to understand communication systems and messages is a really another part, I think, of the approach we're adopting. And then thirdly, and again, the NHS doesn't do this very, very well, is strong systems and processes and culture around recognition. And we've done a lot of work to ensure that, for example, we've got a really vibrant staff awards. We've got a really good culture of identifying, celebrating and calling out good practice, and of ensuring that staff know that actually they do a great job every day that they come to work, and really calling that out and ensuring that people feel recognised for the contribution that they make.
So what comes across to me is that a great deal of thought and work has been put into achieving this progress. Is it the case that this always has to be done on a very slow long-term basis, or do you look out for quick wins as well in terms of making improvements in this area?
So I think it's about both. There is no doubt, and all the evidence says, that you don't create culture overnight. You have to work consistently and serially on culture. So all the evidence says that. But equally, I think certainly when I came into the organization, I found that there was a quick win around senior leadership's visibility that we could do something about very, very, very quickly. And certainly since I've arrived, that we have absolutely turned around, although there is much, much more to do on senior leaders of all types, not just at the board, but below the board, being visible, available in the organization, rather than cooped up in trusted quarters or in other parts of the organization. So that visibility, I think, is a quick win. But living the values, living the behaviors, living the expectations, that is a constant, constant ask. And it doesn't happen overnight. And it takes time for people to believe that that's what you as a leadership team are all about.
And Anthony, we're at a difficult moment, aren't we, for the NHS in lots of ways. How worried are you that the pressures we're seeing, combined with industrial action, could push recent gains into reverse?
So I am very, very worried, because if you look at elements of our staff survey, we have improved on many, many, many domains, but against questions on which I have very little control. So, for example, the satisfaction that my colleagues have with pay, we continue to deteriorate. So I am worried that there is an underlying gap between all of the things that I and my team are doing in my organization to make Pennine the best place it can possibly be to work, and things that are outside my control and the expectations of my colleagues around things like pay, terms and conditions, etc. And clearly, particularly I think for our medical workforce, there is a really high level of dissatisfaction in how they are currently feeling. And of course, we are one big team. So if there are any parts of the workforce that are more dissatisfied than perhaps another, then that is going to have an impact. So workforce is my number one worry, my number one risk, my number one concern. And I am worried that, the progress that we've made won't be sustained. But I'm equally absolutely determined that me and my team do as much as we possibly can to ensure that Pennine feels like a great place to work, and that we take advantage of some of the gains that we've already made.
Anthony Hassell there, Chief Executive at Pennine Care NHS Foundation Trust, ending this special workforce edition of the Provider Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it and found it interesting. We'll be back soon. A reminder, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.